Chapter 3. Captain Giles, after only an instant for reflection, assured him with homely friendliness, "Aye, to be sure. You are right there." He appeared very much gratified indeed, and went away pretty straight to seek a distant long chair. What was he trying to say? I asked with disgust. "I don't know. Mustn't be down too much on the fellow. He's feeling pretty wretched, you may be sure, and tomorrow he'll feel worse yet." Judging by the man's appearance, it seemed impossible. I wondered what sort of complicated debauch had reduced him to that unspeakable condition. Captain Giles' benevolence was spoiled by a curious air of complacency which I disliked. I said with a little laugh, "Well, he will have you to look after him." He made a deprecatory gesture, sat down, and took up a paper. I did the same. The papers were old and uninteresting, filled up mostly with dreary stereotyped descriptions of Queen Victoria's first Jubilee celebrations. Probably we should have quickly fallen into a tropical afternoon doze, if it had not been for Hamilton's voice raised in the dining room. He was finishing his tiffin there. The big double doors stood wide open permanently, and he could not have had any idea how near to the doorway our chairs were placed. He was heard in a loud, supercilious tone answering some statement ventured by the chief steward. "I am not going to be rushed into anything. They will be glad enough to get a gentleman, I imagine. There is no hurry." A loud whispering from the steward succeeded, and then again Hamilton was heard with even intenser scorn. "What? That young ass who fancies himself for having been chief mate with Kent so long? Preposterous. Giles and I looked at each other. "Kent being the came of my late commander, Captain Giles whisper, he's talking of you, seemed to me sheer waste of breath." The chief steward must have stuck to his point, whatever it was, because Hamilton was heard again more supercilious if possible, and also very emphatic. "Rubbish, my good man. One doesn't compete with a rank outsider like that. There's plenty of time." Then there were pushing of chairs, footsteps in the next room, and plaintive expostulations from the steward, who was pursuing Hamilton, even out of doors through the main entrance. "That's a very insulting sort of man," remarked Captain Giles superfluously, I thought. "Very insulting. You haven't offended him in some way, have you?" "Never spoke to him in my life," I said grumpily. "Can't imagine what he means by competing. He has been trying for my job after I left and didn't get it. But that isn't exactly competition." Captain Giles balanced his big benevolent head thoughtfully. "He didn't get it," he repeated very slowly. "Oh, not likely either, with Kent. Kent is no end sorry you left him. He gives you the name of a good seaman too." I flung away the paper I was still holding. I sat up, I slapped the table with my open palm. I wanted to know why he would keep harping on that, my absolutely private affair. It was exasperating, really. Captain Giles silenced me by the perfect equanimity of his gaze. "Owing to be annoyed about," he murmured reasonably, with an evident desire to soothe the childish irritation he had aroused. And he was really a man of an appearance so inoffensive that I tried to explain myself as much as I could. I told him that I did not want to hear any more about what was past and gone. It had been very nice while it lasted, but now it was done with. I preferred not to talk about it, or even think about it. I had made up my mind to go home. He listened to the whole tirade in a particular lending the ear attitude, as if trying to detect a false note in it somewhere, then straightened himself up and appeared to ponder sagaciously over the matter. "Yes. You told me you meant to go home. Anything in view there?" Instead of telling him that it was none of his business, I said sullenly, "Nothing that I know of." I had indeed considered that rather blank side of the situation I had created for myself by leaving suddenly my very satisfactory employment, and I was not very pleased with it. I had it on the tip of my tongue to say that common sense had nothing to do with my action, and that therefore it didn't deserve the interest Captain Giles seemed to be taking in it. But he was puffing at a short wooden pipe now, and looked so guileless, dense, and commonplace, that it seemed hardly worth while to puzzle him either with truth or sarcasm. He blew a cloud of smoke, then surprised me by a very abrupt call and paid your passage money yet? Overcome by the shameless pertinacity of a man to whom it was rather difficult to be rude, I replied with exaggerated meekness that I had not done so yet. I thought there would be plenty of time to do that tomorrow. And I was about to turn away, withdrawing my privacy from his fatuous, objectless attempts to test what sort of stuff it was made of, when he laid down his pipe in an extremely significant manner, you know, as if a critical moment had come, and leaned sideways over the table between us. Oh, you haven't yet? He dropped his voice mysteriously. Well, then I think you ought to know that there's something going on here. I had never in my life felt more detached from all earthly goings-on. Freed from the sea for a time, I preserved the sailor's consciousness of complete independence from all land affairs. How could they concern me? I gazed at Captain Giles' animation with scorn, rather than with curiosity. To his obviously preparatory question whether our steward had spoken to me that day, I said he hadn't. And what's more, he would have had precious little encouragement if he had tried to. I didn't want the fellow to speak to me at all. Unrebuked by my petulance, Captain Giles, with an air of immense sagacity, began to tell me a minute tale about a harbor office peon. It was absolutely pointless. A peon was seen walking that morning on the veranda with a letter in his hand. It was in an official envelope. As the habit of these fellows is, he had shown it to the first white man he came across. That man was our friend in the armchair. He, as I knew, was not in a state to interest himself in any sublunary matters. He could only wave the peon away. The peon then wandered on along the veranda and came upon Captain Giles, who was there by an extraordinary chance. At this point he stopped with a profound look. The letter, he continued, was addressed to the chief steward. Now what could Captain Ellis, the master attendant, want to write to the steward for? The fellow went every morning, anyhow, to the harbor office with his report, for orders or whatnot. He hadn't been back more than an hour before there was an office peon chasing him with a note. Now what was that for? And he began to speculate. It was not for this, and it could not be for that. As to that other thing, it was unthinkable. The fatuousness of all this made me stare. If the man had not been somehow a sympathetic personality, I would have resented it like an insult. As it was, I felt only sorry for him. Something remarkably earnest in his gaze prevented me from laughing in his face. Neither did I yawn at him. I just stared. His tone became a shade more mysterious. Directly the fellow, meaning the steward, got that note, he rushed for his hat and bolted out of the house. But it wasn't because the note called him to the harbor office. He didn't go there. He was not absent long enough for that. He came darting back in no time, flung his hat away, and raced about the dining room moaning and slapping his forehead. All these exciting facts and manifestations had been observed by Captain Giles. He had, it seems, been meditating upon them ever since. I began to pity him profoundly. And in a tone which I tried to make as little sarcastic as possible, I said that I was glad he had found something to occupy his morning hours. With his disarming simplicity, he made me observe, as if it were a matter of some consequence, how strange it was that he should have spent the morning indoors at all. He generally was out before tiffin, visiting various offices, seeing his friends in the harbor, and so on. He had felt out of sorts somewhat on rising. Nothing much. Just enough to make him feel lazy. All this with a sustained, holding stare which, in conjunction with the general inanity of the discourse, conveyed the impression of mild, dreary lunacy. and when he hitched his chair a little and dropped his voice to the low note of mystery, it flashed upon me that high professional repute Italian was not necessarily a guarantee of sound mind. It never occurred to me then that I didn't know in what soundness of mind exactly consisted, and what a delicate and, upon the whole, an important matter it was. With some idea of not hurting his feelings, I blinked at him in an interested manner. But when he proceeded to ask me mysteriously whether I remembered what had passed just now between that steward of ours and Hatman Hamilton, I only grunted sourly assent and turned away my head. "Aye. But do you remember every word?" he insisted tactfully. "I don't know. It's none of my business," I snapped out, consigning, moreover, the steward and Hamilton aloud to eternal perdition. I meant to be very energetic and final, but Captain Giles continued to gaze at me thoughtfully. Nothing could stop him. He went on to point out that my personality was involved in that conversation. When I tried to preserve the semblance of unconcern, he became positively cruel. "I heard what the man had said?" "Yes." "What did I think of it then?" he wanted to know. Captain Giles' appearance excluding the suspicion of mere sly malice, I came to the conclusion that he was simply the most tactless idiot on earth. I almost despised myself for the weakness of attempting to enlighten his common understanding. I started to explain that I did not think anything whatever. Hamilton was not worth a thought. What such an offensive loafer. That he is, interjected Captain Giles. Thought or said was below any decent man's contempt, and I did not propose to take the slightest notice of it. This attitude seemed to me so simple and obvious that I was really astonished at Giles giving no sign of assent. Such perfect stupidity was almost interesting. "What would you like me to do?" I asked, laughing. "Can't start a row with him, because of the opinion he has formed of me. Of course, I've heard of the contemptuous way he alludes to me. But he doesn't intrude his contempt on my notice. He has never expressed it in my hearing. For even just now he didn't know we could hear him. I should only make myself ridiculous." That hopeless Giles went on puffing at his pipe moodily. All at once his face cleared, and he spoke. "You missed my point." "Have I? I am very glad to hear it," I said. With increasing animation he stated again that I had missed his point. Entirely. And in a tone of growing self-conscious complacency he told me that few things escaped his attention. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.